This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Women's History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Jane Semeca, professor of history at Brookdale Community College. Today, we'll be discussing a new book by Dr. Lee Gilmore titled The Me Too Effect, What Happens When We Believe Women, published by Columbia University Press. Dr. Gilmore is a professor emerita of English at Ohio State University. She is the author of several books, including Tainted Witness, Why We Doubt Women, What Women Say About Their Lives, The Limits of Autobiography, Trauma and Testimony, and Autobiographics, A Feminist Theory of Self-Representation. She also contributes regularly to WBUR's Cognoscenti. Lee, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jane. I'm delighted to be talking with you.
So what led you to write this book?
Well, I came to this project because, like many people, in the middle of October 2017, I was online and I watched Me Too begin to trend on social media. I had a unique perspective because I had just published a book called Tainted Witness, which argued that doubt hounds women when they bear witness to experiences that challenged institutional and political authority. And nowhere does this happen more explicitly than with sexual violence. So the Me Too movement, on one hand, confronted me with this seemingly utopian prospect the utopian rejoinder to Why We Doubt What Women Say About Their Lives, which is the subtitle of Tainted Witness, with this episode of credibility. And the subtitle of the Me Too effect is What Happens When We Believe Women. But I would say that this moment of credibility, although it was described as unprecedented in virtually every single news report about it, is that it was operating in the same ways that I had charted that women's testimony often circulated, which is that it's frequently halted initially and often subsequently in efforts to report to police, to inform institutional authorities, to tell friends and family that something terrible has happened. But even when it's stalled, that testimony continues to move in search of an adequate witness. And with the emergence of Me Too as this kind of container for an outpouring of previously unheard testimonies about sexual violence, it seemed that survivors had found that adequate witness.
Wow. Okay. So, can you talk about what Me Too is in case there's anyone listening who is not aware of what this movement is about?
So Me Too frequently refers to a kind of dual origin story, maybe even a fractured origin story about this particular episode in a long history of feminist anti-rape activism. And one part of the origin story is that Alyssa Milano tweeted in response to the Harvey Weinstein allegations that it would give everyone a sense of the scale of the problem of sexual violence if everyone who'd had this experience tweeted Me Too. And that created an echo to previous hashtag campaigns that were specifically related to sexual violence. The hashtag Why I Stayed, the one about Bill Cosby, hashtag The Empty Chair. And Twitter has always been able to host organic feminist publics around particular issues. And publics have been able to focus on sexual violence around particular trials. But this was something different. And I think the reason that it was different was not only that it was enabled by social media, but that it was basically Me Too was a quote. It was an unattributed citation to a movement created by the activist Tarana Burke. She's also written a memoir called Unbound that describes her experience of developing the movement, how she came to develop the Me Too movement. So there was always, from the start, this kind of dual aspect to Me Too. And what I wanted to do in the book was to put those two stories together, and in some ways to subordinate the social media story to the longer history of narrative activism that I see as central to survivor movements to end sexual violence.
It is so powerful when survivors of violence get together, and it can be so transformative when people share. I had an experience in a women's and gender studies panel one day at my college where I teach, where a panel of students were talking about sexual assault and sexual harassment. And the students in the audience started to stand up and talk about what was happening to them where they worked. And it's a community college. The students, almost all of them, have some kind of a job on the side. Most of them work in hospitality or bars or restaurants. The flexibility and the income is substantial, so it's very helpful for students. And one by one, they started sharing about how they were assaulted and harassed by their customers, who they relied on their tips, so they couldn't say anything, or by their coworkers in the kitchen. And it was absolutely mind-blowing to me how ubiquitous, how widespread this kind of behavior is. And so I think that this book is so important for us to read and to share with our students to reinforce and to support survivors and for people to feel like they're not alone as well. So I think that this book has such important resonance as both an academic discussion of the history of Me Too and the feminist philosophy behind it, but also in a very personal way to talk and to help people to understand the structure of power around what they have experienced. So can we talk a little bit then about, you mentioned narrative activism in your previous response. So can you talk a little bit about what narrative activism is?
I define narrative activism as storytelling in the service of social change. And what you said is an example of that. What research now shows, you know, pretty undeniably and thoroughly, is that sexual violence interrupts women and the lives of women and girls at every phase of activity, young through old, at work, at home, in school, in sports, in intimate relationships, in relationships of structured authority, at levels of professional attainment, at entry-level positions. It's ubiquitous. It's prevalent. And so often, the mechanisms for reporting it go nowhere where there are processes for reporting. And so people are stuck with these unheard stories and unaddressed harms and go through life mired down by them. It strikes me as profoundly unjust and something that we should do something about. What the Me Too moment afforded was a lowering of the bar to telling your own story and multiplying the prospect of being heard. You didn't have to, all you had to do was use the words Me Too. You didn't have to name names. You didn't have to file a complaint. You didn't have to go to the police. You didn't have to imagine the harm you might do to somebody's reputation. It took all of those trained, habituated mechanisms of silencing off the table briefly. And so as people felt able to share on social media, and data from Twitter indicates that people saw at least 7 stories of Me Too in their personal network before they shared. So it wasn't the Alyssa Milano tweet. It wasn't the front page news. It was the observation and the connection that something was happening close to home for them and that they were able to be heard finally. And, you know, that kind of emergence of a collective voice that didn't deny the specificity of any particular story or try to roll all the stories into the same story, but they enabled all the separate different stories to come together and to make the pattern visible, to make the pattern of the pervasiveness and the prevalence of sexual violence visible, to make the default cultural narratives of doubt applied to survivors visible, and to allow us to hear in their own words, often the words of abusers who often said, I wanted to do that. And so I did it, as Trump did on the Access Hollywood tape. Those came together to create this new opening for stories of sexual violence to be told. In this particular moment, that certainly has been happening. But that has been happening for a long time. And narrative activism has, in my book, I mark a provisional beginning with a slave narrative, Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl by Harriet Jacobs, who in the middle of the 1900s used the narrative of the genre of the slave narrative, which is an autobiographical and a testimonial form that gives the speaker the authority of the eyewitness. They use that form to tell a very personal story. So it certainly is a broad legal theory of abolition that connects the sexual violence of slavery with the racial harm of it. And she makes that case through telling her own story of being preyed upon sexually by the person who is enslaving her. And she writes very honestly and openly about the attack on her integrity as a human being and on her virtue as a woman. And she puts the choices that she makes in her life in the context of that abolitionist critique. So that's an early example of telling a personal story about sexual violence in the service of making a larger social and structural critique. And that's really the fusion of Me Too. It's that structural critique with a personal story. It's different from a memoir that focuses on the individual and the individual's unique plight. It seeks to tell a collective story, a story that in some way has been going on for a long time that the survivor wants to join. And that's a story that uses sentiment, uses feeling, uses all the things that have been used against survivors and leverages them toward this testimonial power and authority.
Yeah, and to make change, right? And, you know, the idea of telling vivid stories is very important throughout history of trying to make social change, trying to change public opinion, and something Martin Luther King understood, something that, Andrew Del Banco actually writes about when he talks about in his book, The War Before the War, about trying to make social change and to change people's opinions on structure that they accept as normal by telling the vivid stories. And I think that this is these stories of sexual assault and harassment have over the last 50 years really create this narrative arc as we've added more stories on the end, right? As you get all the way up to recent scandals and recent stories that have entered our you know, our consciousness, really do, I think, make a very big impact in that narrative activism, right? To change public opinion, to give a sense of solidarity among survivors as well. And so you mentioned the role that social media plays in this. So social media gets a lot of criticism. So, you know, it's interesting to see that there is a new, it's a relatively new medium for us as a society. So social media played an important role here. Can you talk a little bit further about that?
One of the accusations against Me Too is that it's extrajudicial. And I think it is extrajudicial because it's been forced to be. So nobody, I mean, I say this with a grain of salt, but nobody wants to share a story of rape, sexual harassment, or sexual assault first on Twitter. If there was somewhere else for those stories to go where they would be heard, that's where they would go. They would go through a fair complaint process. They would go through a credible criminal legal system. They would go into a kind of restorative justice project. So if there were other outlets, that's where they would have gone. But social media offered something unique, which is that I think it did something it didn't intend to do. So that's, you know, sort of talk about affordances, like what the medium allows to have happen, even that it doesn't necessarily intend. So by law and by sort of cultural agreement, sexual assault cases spanning harassment to rape are heard in the United States and more broadly within a he said, she said paradigm. And he said, she said is really a false equivalence narrative. She said, he raped me. He said, no, I didn't. That was consensual sex. So it's about the power and the authority of one person to name the reality of the experience. And he said, she said gives disproportionate weight to what he said. And what the law allows is for every single survivor to be doubted one at a time. And doubt and discrediting are woven into the law structurally through our burdens of proof and through bias and stereotype against women as witnesses, so much so that I would argue it's structurally unfair. And he said, she said, amplifies the disproportionate power and authority that men have in the law. So what happened with the uninterrupted flow of millions of stories is that Me Too disrupted he said, she said with we said, and it collectivized credibility. Now, it didn't do what it has been sometimes caricatured as doing, which is insist that that rape is the one thing nobody could ever lie about, then you must believe all women. Instead, it made survivors potentially credible, someone who could be believed rather than somebody who must be doubted. And that was a real transformation. And I do think that we can credit social media with that smooth flow of the prevalence and scale of sexual violence to millions of people. So that knowledge was distributed. And when that knowledge was distributed, it was shocking to many people. And so previously, many people had either a vague idea of what sexual harassment or assault or rape might look like, sound like, or be. Maybe it was drawn from the movies. Maybe it was drawn from stereotype, the handsy boss chasing the secretary around the desk, like something from the 50s or something. But with stories about Harvey Weinstein, Matt Lauer, famous men, a broad public had indelible images of just exactly what coercion and abuse look like. And that was, many people said that was new and that was transformative to them to understand. And some people even said it was the same as seeing George Floyd being murdered by police officers, that they knew it was bad. They understood the history of it and the ongoingness of it. But they said that seeing it in that way, watching it, pulled them from a position of observation merely to participation. And so I was sort of talking the book about how we should think about Me Too as a breakthrough moment, that it has features of other breakthroughs where suddenly there's a saturation of information. Many people can quote statistics about the frequency of rape, for example, but that saturation has to translate into visibility. Like, so you see it in a new way. You know it, but then you see it in a new way. And once it becomes visible in a new way, then people are called off the sidelines and they no longer think it's something that happens far away from them, but they understand that it's a very, more than highly likely, it's, very likely that someone they know has been sexually assaulted or raped, that they will at some point hear one of those stories, that might be their story, and that these disparate and divided elements of human experience began to come together in a way to produce knowledge.
You know, it's interesting, and I was thinking about this when I was watching the Academy Awards this year, because Jodie Foster was nominated for her role in the movie Naiad, but she had, and so they were reviewing her career during the Academy Award, lead up to the Academy Awards. And I got to remember a little bit about the movie she was in when she played somebody who had been raped in a bar. I think it's called Accused. Yeah. And I remember that being it was a movie in the 90s, I believe. And so that was another one of those cultural moments where the sympathy of the audience and the frustration of the audience with this survivor of the sexual assault is eye-opening. And it is one of those moments also. So sometimes it's not just one George Floyd moment, maybe, as well as, you know, sort of maybe a confluence of several things. So let's talk about, you know, that was just something that came to mind just now, but I wanted to talk to you about what I think is one of the turning points is the Clarence Thomas hearings, the confirmation of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill's testimony, where she described the long pattern of sexual harassment, and she was not believed. And I wonder if you could sort of fit that example. That was such an important moment in this story of believing women and changing attitudes towards survivors.
You know, the Anita Hill Clarence Thomas hearings are an episode in American legal and cultural life that continues to resound into the future. I mean, we have Clarence Thomas now actively hearing a case about Trump's immunity claim without recusing himself, despite the fact that his wife is an insurrectionist. So the gift of Clarence Thomas over these decades is one that Anita Hill attempted as best she could to prevent being delivered to us. And she did it out of a sense of civic duty. She did it out of a sense of professional ethics as a lawyer. And she did it with no hope of anything other than advising the committee on a matter of grave importance. And for that, she was subjected during the hearings to a kind of vilification that was stunning, not only in its aggression and weirdness, but in its bald-faced lies. So and I dig into this quite a bit in the book, but the Republican members of the Senate Judiciary Committee were did not say that they were telling the truth about her as they followed up on this. They aggressively lied. They sought to paint her as crazy, as vindictive, as a woman scorned, you know, name your stereotype. And they did it all with a kind of unremediated sexism. And what they also attempted to do was to split Anita Hill off from her identity as an African-American woman and align her with professional white women. What she said of the hearings is he, Clarence Thomas, had a race. I had a gender. And it was meant to sort of diminish her, to use anti-feminist tropes and misogynist tropes to present her as not credible. And she withstood this in a way that I think most people watching thought was admirable. And many people were persuaded. And in fact, when she returned home after the hearings, she found boxes of mail. And basically the prefiguring of a Me Too movement, where women from all over the country wrote to her and said, this also happened to me. So was there was that outpouring. So in a sense, it shows what can happen when someone stands up and even takes that kind of brutal discrediting, utterly undeserved, of course, except for the fact that what she was doing was politically very powerful. And so it was pure and simple retaliation. But two famous journalists were also watching. Jane Mayer, who continues to write for The New Yorker, and Jill Abramson, who was for a time the editor of The New York Times. And both of them thought, well, this is a he said, she said. And it's going to turn out that there's going to be evidence on both sides of lying, and we'll just have to weigh that. And instead, they wrote a giant book called Strange Justice, The Selling of Clarence Thomas. And they said, we didn't find any evidence to suggest that anything other than exactly what she said happened. So what we see again and again are these eruptions in public life of credibility of survivors. And what we can witness also is that there are no institutional structures to hold and preserve that and to make change based on them. So between the time that Anita Hill testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee that Clarence Thomas had sexually harassed her when she worked as his employee, to the time that Christine Blasey Ford wanted to inform the Senate Judiciary Committee that Brett Kavanaugh had sexually assaulted her, attempted to rape her when they were teenagers, there was no mechanism in place to report that. So you'd think that a sincere effort would have been made to prevent not only what happened to Anita Hill, to prevent that from happening again, but to enable those who might have this kind of important advisorial information to contribute it to the process. And that didn't happen. So the suppression of these stories occurs through the maintenance of structures that prevent women from speaking out.
Yeah, absolutely. It's and I remember not that long ago, I think it was maybe 2018, that the Congress, at Amy Klobuchar's insistence, stopped paying for the sexual harassment claims of the members of Congress.
Right.
And I remember cutting that article out and just being gobsmacked that the American people would be paying the for the defense of congressmen who are sexually harassing their aides in Congress. You know, that it is this, that the structure of the very highest echelons of corporate America, media, and politics do not have any mechanism for or respect for looking at these claims.
It's, well, in Congress, those claims are heard through the Ethics Committee, which is staffed by congresspeople. So there are no third-party investigations. Those congresspeople are provided with legal counsel. Those who are bringing complaints are not. And there is no timetable there for the hearings. There's no compulsion that they conclude. They are absolutely, you know, are run by those who have a strong incentive to delay the revelation of evidence, to tire out and exhaust witnesses, and to stall, and then to hush it up at the end because they don't have to publish their findings. And this is, you know, so I write about that in the book, especially with Bob Packwood, who some people might remember, but he's, you know, quite a character.
That part of the book is hair-raising. What he does is hair-raising.
So writing about that, I think, raises a particular challenge or set of concerns for humanities scholars. And in a way, offering the kinds of close readings that literary scholars like myself typically direct toward literary texts, but taking those skills of close reading and close analysis and applying them to transcripts, applying them to audio tapes, and pulling out of them, not just the main topic that they talked about or just the summary of it, but to really give a sense of what sexual violence feels and sounds like when it's being described, when it's being enacted, and when it's being adjudicated. And all of that, I think, suggests that there's such a powerful role for the humanities to play in leveraging our set of skills toward the analysis and the understanding of these intractable cultural problems.
Absolutely. You know, I've been teaching women's history since the late 1990s. And when I teach about the Anita Hill testimony, I always have my students in class or in writing or on their tests talk about, was Anita Hill sexually harassed in your opinion? Here's the standards, the EEOC standards for sexual harassment. They have to learn that for class. Then we have this story. And it used to be, before 2017, there would be about 25% of the class would say, you know, I don't think that what happened to her rises to the level of sexual harassment. And they would dispassionately talk about how she didn't report it contemporaneous with the events and that they didn't believe that she was sexually harassed. After 2017, it's almost silly for me to ask my students because they all 100% are in agreement that she was sexually harassed. And so that's just like an anecdotal sample of the students in my women's history classes. But I have really noticed that before and after 2017, that this sense of collective understanding of sexual harassment has changed.
I agree that that Me Too laid down a marker. There's before Me Too and there's after Me Too. And after Me Too, there's a rising expectation that men will be held accountable for sexual violence, right? So I think that's what shifted, is from doubt to credibility for survivors and from impunity to accountability for abusers. One of the things that people said about Anita Hill in order to discredit her claim of sexual harassment was that she stayed in touch with Clarence Thomas,
yes,
that she maintained a professional connection over time.
She asked her for letters of recommendation, things like that.
Which he owed her, right, as her supervisor. And so I think you see that coming around again with the Harvey Weinstein case. So we're talking on Friday, the day after Harvey Weinstein's New York conviction for rape was overturned. And it's interesting to me that he's back in the news at the same time, at exactly the same time that Trump is in the news for the E. Jean Carroll rape and defamation trials. Now, the federal appeals court overturned the conviction of Harvey Weinstein by the slimmest possible measure, 4-3, because they said that he had been denied a fair trial for two reasons. One is that the prosecution called bad prior act witnesses, four women, to say that he had done to them what he did to the two women who were at the heart of the criminal complaint. That was one of the pieces of evidence used to overturn the verdict. The other was that it was kind of tricky from the start because the women had had consensual sex with Weinstein earlier and then did not. But I really, you know, as I listen to this, and there's going to be a lot of commentary on this and a lot of diving into what it might mean. But in many of the news articles I've seen, the claim that the case was fragile from the start strikes me as something that we need to push back on. So the fragility of it is baked into the structure of the law. It's not that it was, you know, sort of like found in the wild and was not able to survive on its own. Whether or not a case is strong depends on what the law will enable a prosecutor to do. And in the case of the massive allegations against Harvey Weinstein, more than 100, he had run out the clock on his victims, statutes of limitations had expired. He had assaulted some of them outside the state of New York. He had sexually harassed some of them, which are not criminal charges, but civil charges. Not all of them wanted to come forward because trauma does something to people, and not everyone is up for that to go through a process that victims consistently refer to as re-traumatizing. So the prosecution used Molyneux witnesses, and it's got a goofy name because it's actually legally permissible since 1901 in New York to call bad prior act witnesses. And the jury believed them. The jury also believed that consent is not given once and eternally granted forever. You can say no after you've said yes. And what changed was juries after Me Too understood both of those things. They understood pattern because they had seen millions of women come forward without being disrupted by he said, she said, and they understood the complexities of consent, why someone would stay in touch with a Harvey Weinstein or a Clarence Thomas because they had a professional relationship with them and because those are also dangerous men to have aimed against you. Their threats of retaliation are very plausible. So I find it interesting that the lessons of Me Too have been heard and need to continue to be reinforced because the antagonists in the room are so overly powerful, the law, patriarchy, you name it. And of course, Me Too couldn't end patriarchy or improve the law wholesale, but it has made a change in understanding among people who would be seated on juries. And moreover, and perhaps I think most importantly, it's not particularly designed as a carceral movement. No one is more skeptical of the criminal legal system than survivors of sexual assault and abuse. So the power of narrative activism is that it leaps outside the courtroom where it's managed and silenced and dismissed. And it comes into the public for discussion and debate, for the creation of new awareness and understanding, and for the production of credible witnesses. And I think that's really the movement and the momentum of the future, is that yes, some things in the law will change, and I hope more than less. But the understanding of the dignity and of survivors and that people are owed something when they're injured, even if it's a fair hearing, is I think really important. And that's why the book concludes with the question, what do we owe survivors? And I think, you know, after doing this research, my conclusion is to listen to what survivors ask for. And what they ask for over and over again is not revenge, although maybe some would if that were more culturally permissible for survivors of all gender, but that's not what they ask for. What they ask for time and again is transparent processes for reporting, right? That there be processes for reporting and that they be transparent. Third-party investigations, right? So that the Congress can't police itself, or, you know, so, you know, you don't get charted, tracked into mediation where you're really disadvantaged. So third-party investigations, and when there are findings of fact, and you know, through an investigative process, that proportional penalties be levied, not necessarily carceral, not necessarily monetary, but that proportional penalties be levied so that the person did not go through this process in vain. Interestingly, survivors also are quite divided on asking for apologies. They're typically, they don't believe they matter. They don't trust that they have any meaning. And so they often don't ask for them. What they want instead is a different kind of making it right. They want to be restored to the community or to the culture or to the organization where the abuse was enabled to go on. And that's more typically what survivors ask for.
You know, it's interesting. And so you brought up Donald Trump and the E. Jean Carroll case, which was found to be responsible for sexually assaulting her. And he persists in defaming her. And she has persisted in having him be held to, you know, to be charged with defamation. So she has really, you know, it's interesting how she has continued to. She's such an amazing heroine in this situation of standing up to the bully, who, you know, says he doesn't even remember who she is. And I don't even know that person, right? So the E. Jean Carroll case, I think, has really been incredibly important in that kind of holding the rapist accountable, even though they're not apologetic, even though they're not in any way contrite in any respect. But to hold them to account through the courts. And all these cases coming up at the same time we can only imagine what the impact that's going to be in the future of how this movement is going to continue into the future. You know, and I remember walking into class in 2017 when the Time magazine came out that made the Silence Breakers Time magazine person of the year. And I think we have to recognize that the weight of Me Too, right? The impact of Me Too has had incredible, even this is only 7 years since then, less than 7 years, that we can see that it definitely has made a sea change. And I would say too, I mean, I really think this book is really important. I find that when I speak to my students and we talk about sexual harassment, we go through the legal guidelines for it. We talk about some of these examples, and I feel it's a real responsibility for us as teachers, academics, mentors, mothers, sisters, to have these conversations, to raise awareness. It's almost a consciousness raising moment. For people who did, how dare you go out into the world and go to work, go to school, and live with this idea that this could happen to you? And it just is, to me as a teacher, I feel it's a very important context to provide to them about what sexual harassment is and to raise their consciousness about it.
One really interesting report that I looked at for the book was about sexual harassment in the sciences and academic medicine. And the authors of that study, Sheila Widnall at MIT and Paula Johnson at Wellesley College, identified the outsized powers that gatekeepers possess in the lives of young scientists. The numbers of women who are being sexually harassed out of the sciences is vast. And what they identified was the importance, the effectiveness of work cultures in ending sexual harassment, that whenever the leadership spoke, they were, if they said our three top priorities are, you know, end cancer, get that next round of funding, and end sexual harassment in our lab, that every time they articulated it as a goal of the culture itself, that that reduced instances of sexual violence and sexual harassment. People who are most vulnerable to sexual harassment and sexual violence are the people who are most vulnerable generally in culture. It's queer and trans people, Black and brown people, girls and women, and that survivors of all genders are treated and harassed as disempowered persons and expendable. And often what happens in organizations is that there's a sort of bystander culture that's created where the people who don't report find that they are being eased upward in the organization, that there are many people who would never consider themselves participants in sexual harassment, and yet they are beneficiaries of it. The queue gets shorter. Some people get harassed out of the workplace, they curry favor with a sexually harassing head of a lab, for example. But that the importance of leadership, I think, is one place that we want to focus. I'm often asked, you know, what should survivors do? What's your advice for survivors? And one answer to that is everyone else should do better in making sure that that sexual violence is prevented in the first place, and that institutions hold accountable those who perpetrate it. That's what we owe, right? That there's an ethical obligation entailed by hearing millions of stories of sexual violence. You can't say you don't know, and you are required to act. Otherwise, it's just immiserating, you know, to just permit this to continue without in some way standing up for what's right. And so I think that when you see a rear guard action, like the overturning of Weinstein's conviction or the constant defaming of E. Jean Carroll by Donald Trump, that when you see that, you have to, you know, not only call it out publicly, but put pressure on those who are responsible for ending that. So continue to put pressure on that, you know, so will Weinstein be charged again in New York? Three of the justices in a blistering dissent said exactly what they thought of that majority opinion. It was wrong. It was harmful. Will those charges be brought again?
If it's up to Letitia James, I'm sure she will be on that.
Yes.
You know, and so, you know, I think that one of the things that maybe we can be a little hopeful for as we conclude our conversation today is that there are clearly a lot more women attorneys general, and a lot more women in prosecutors' offices to perhaps push back against some of the injustice in the way that these cases are being prosecuted and being prepared. So, you know, perhaps the feminist movement has definitely made a very important contribution to awareness, to changing rape laws, to Title IX and having more women in the legal profession, and for having these conversations. I feel that your book is so important for the classroom and for anyone who is interested in Me Too, for having the conversation about what harassment is, what assault is, and for giving people the vocabulary to have to look at it and analyze it. And so I thank you so much for writing this book and for joining me on the show today. The book is titled The Me Too Effect: What Happens When We Believe Women, published by Columbia University Press. Thank you, Lee Gilmore. Thank you so much. Until next time on New Books in Women's History, this is Jane Semeca. Keep reading.